evening and welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, psychologist, counselor, and marriage and family therapist. Our topic this evening is going to be autism spectrum disorder, and we want to invite our listeners to call in with any comments or questions you might have. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. This evening we have several guests. We have with us Dr. Michelle Yetman, psychologist, Mike McGill, speech language pathologist, and then Mary Catherine Schroeder. She is the mother of two kids with the on the autism spectrum. Welcome everyone this evening. I want to first start by everybody just kind of introducing themselves. Dr. Yetman, if you want to start, just tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
Sure. I'm a clinical psychologist and an assistant professor at LSU, the School of Allied Health, in the Children's Center. And we have an outpatient clinic. We see children between the ages of 2 and 15 for a variety of reasons. But one of our biggest referral questions is autistic spectrum disorder. We also see children for developmental issues such as delays, ADHD, and learning disabilities. And my partner in crime is sitting right beside me, Mike McGill.
Hi. I'm a speech-language pathologist, part of the team at the Children's Center, the multidisciplinary team. I'm also an assistant professor. I come from a background in special education, and we do, like Dr. Yetman said, quite a few autism spectrum evaluations as well as treatment.
And Mary Catherine?
Yeah, my name's Mary Catherine Schroeder. I have two little boys, 5 and 3. Grayson is 5. He was diagnosed with autism when he was 2 years old. And Sutton is almost 3, and he was also diagnosed with autism at 2, both at LSU.
And y'all probably hear this already, but y'all do fabulous work over there at LSU, and we really thank y'all for your services and everything you do. I know that I have clients all the time that just sing your praises as to all the services you offer and how wonderful they are and how many people's lives you've changed. I want to invite our listeners to call in with a question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. And just whoever would like to take this one, just tell us a little bit about autism spectrum disorder. What is it?
Well, autism spectrum disorder, and it is a spectrum, meaning it can present in a range of manifestations. It is a neurobiological disorder, and there's no blood test for it yet. There's no brain scan for it yet. So it is diagnosed, and Mike McGill can talk about the process of diagnosing it, but it's diagnosed through examining signs and symptoms. But it really is a spectrum. And there's an expression, you know, if you've met one child with autism, you've met one child with autism. Just from a personal example, I have twin nephews, both of which are on the autistic spectrum. One of which, my nephew, Michael, has been won a full scholarship to University of Connecticut. He's very extremely bright, very outgoing. If he met you, he'd want to interact with you. He has memorized every sports statistic. That is his restricted area of interest. That's all he wants to talk about. He knows everything about sports. So obviously it's very hard for me to have a conversation with him because I know nothing about sports. We kind of really get stuck there. He'd do great with Mike. They could talk all day. But he really struggles to talk about things other than sports. But he's very, very bright. His twin brother, Jason, my other nephew, has co-occurring intellectual disability, is completely nonverbal, has never spoken, has severe aggressive behaviors, has a very restricted diet. They're twin brothers, and they both have autism, but you can see by my little snippet of a presentation of them, they look very, very different, yet they both have the exact same, quote, diagnosis. And so it can present in a range of presentations, and that's why we say if you met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism.
Sure, it is a spectrum. It goes all the way from one end to the other. Mm-hmm. So what about diagnosing autism spectrum disorder? How does that happen? Who do you see?
So at the Children's Center, we have a team of psychologists, an occupational therapist, I'm a speech language pathologist, and a physician. And we use a team approach. We do use the gold standard instrument. It's called the ADOS, which stands for Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. And like Dr. Yetman said, there's no blood test, there's no brain scan to diagnose autism. And so we're really basing this on behavioral observations. And I'm on the team, I'm the communication expert. And so I'm looking at certain things with communication based on their language level and their age, looking for kind of red flags. For instance, a child who doesn't have, so this ADOS, it tests children anywhere on the spectrum. So from kids that don't have any language all the way up to adults who are fully conversational. But the signs and symptoms of autism are the core signs and symptoms are going to be the same. They just present differently. And so with this ADOS, what we're looking for, it's really a play-based assessment for young children. So I'm looking for, even if a child doesn't have speech and language, how do they compensate for their lack of speech and language? Are they using gestures and signs? Are they bringing toys to parents and the examiners to engage them? Also, we're looking at certain behaviors that are just characteristic, really, of an autistic spectrum disorder. So those, you know, how children play, are they playing are they using imaginative play? Are they lining up toys? Are they using toys in unusual kinds of ways? So after we've done our observations as a team, we get together and we quantify these qualitative behaviors, and the ADOS has a rubric at the end. So the higher the score, the more likely the child is on the spectrum. So it's a process.
And I know the Children's Center is very child friendly, and I know that the type of testing that you do, you try to be as non-invasive as possible. So, you know, Right. Doing the observational and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and we see a lot of younger children. They have no idea they're being tested. They just come in, and it's a very play-based assessment, but we're making lots of observations.
Yeah.
And there's also a parent interview component, a very detailed parent interview component. And, you know, Mary Catherine's been through it twice, so I'm sure she could share her experience with the process of going through it, too.
Like Mike said, when my kids went to get tested, they really thought they were just playing. They had no idea that we were observing them and trying to, you know, find out what behaviors that would maybe give them a sense of having a red flag that something was wrong.
Mm-hmm. And we have a caller. We have Deb from Shreveport. Go right ahead with your question or comment.
I appreciate it. I have a 28-year-old daughter who's been diagnosed with Asperger's. And as a younger age, she used to go through these meltdowns where she would lay on the floor and bang her back of her head on the floor. I'd have to just lay there with her and put my hands around her. But today, what she's doing is she goes through these meltdowns and she bites herself. And I was wondering y'all's opinion on CBD.
That's a good question.
Beg your pardon?
I'm sorry, that's a great question. Go on.
Yeah. I was just wondering if y'all had an opinion about that as of yet.
That's a great question. That's a very exciting line of research. For people who don't know, CBD oil is a derivative from marijuana. So there's two components to marijuana. There's the THC component, which is the part that gets you high, and then there's the other component that can be extracted, which is the CBD oil that does not get you high. There's a lot of research going into CBD oil. People are using it as an analgesic for pain relief, for back pain, for a variety of different uses. Outside of the United States, the biggest researchers are Israel, Canada, and the Netherlands in terms of looking at CBD oil and its therapeutic value with children with autism who also have what Doug's describing as co-occurring self-injurious behavior. Some children with autism have these self-injurious behaviors, and they can be very severe. Head banging, biting, scratching, they can be very, very destructive. Currently, how we manage them is often with antipsychotic medication, antipsychotic drugs. While they can help some, they often have side effects that can be difficult to tolerate, and they're not always 100% effective. And so there's research going on outside the United States looking at use of medical marijuana with these behaviors to curb these behaviors. Within the United States, CHOP, which is Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is doing an observational study where parents who are giving their children medical marijuana, CHOP is monitoring these children and seeing if it helps with the behavior. Dr. Vancheri, I don't think there's a study up and running, but he has voiced interest in doing this line of research. Basically, it looks like Louisiana might approve the use of medical marijuana for children with ASD and severe behavioral difficulties. Our current position is we need to do more research in it. One of the questions is, does CBD alone work? Or do you need the THC component? If CBD oil is effective, how much would you need to give a child? Like, how would you dose that? We don't know these answers yet, and the only way we're going to be able to answer those questions is through doing controlled research. So it's a very fruitful area of study. Those of us in this field were very eager to see this research come out because it does have potential.
So Mary Catherine, would you speak a little bit about what it's like to be a parent of actually two children on the spectrum? What is that day-to-day and just in general, what's that like?
Sure. The first word that comes to my mind is stressful. It's very stressful. And there's just a lot of questions, you know. It's not like you wake up one day and you say, my kid's autistic. It's kind of a process. I was told initially, you know, Grayson's not responding to his name and maybe he has just a hearing problem. And then, you know, I was told Grayson's not maturing as fast as, you know, his peers his age, but it's just a maturity thing and it's because he's a boy. I was also told, that it was just a speech delay, you know, and so you keep making these excuses up and kind of praying that that's what it is. But then, you know, you put two and two together, you stay up late at night thinking about it, and all of a sudden the pieces come together and you're like, this is what it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so when your children were diagnosed, was that kind of a sigh of relief, or was that, now we have this to deal with, or kind of what was that process?
It's kind
like?
Of both. Mm-hmm. So it was a sigh of relief in the fact that, like, okay, I'm not crazy. Like, you know, I thought like Grayson would throw a 45-minute meltdown, and I had no idea why. And so it was like, there is a reason. There's a neurological reason why he's doing this. And so it was almost like a validation that, yes, motherhood is hard, but surely it's not supposed to be this hard.
Yeah.
And but it's also just sadness because you're kind of losing a child in a way. Like, you're losing who you thought your child was going to be.
And I know sometimes parents can get blamed for some of these behavioral problems, and so some of the professionals they meet with may say, well, you're not disciplining properly, or you're not doing this properly, or things like that.
Right. And it's such a disguised diagnosis. You know, no one knows that your child is autistic when they just see them. They just see two regular average looking boys, and they have no idea that something's going on. So when they have a meltdown, then, you know, I feel like I'm being judged as a mom, and they don't really know the whole story.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Dub, thank you so much for your call, and we want to invite our other listeners to call in with a question or a comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. And Dr. Yetman, I understand that there are some brand new hot off the presses numbers as far as prevalence rates. Would you share a little bit of that with us?
Yes, this literally is hot off the press. This was released by the CDC today, the Center for Disease Control. Yes, as of yesterday, we thought the rates of autism was 1 in 68 children. The CDC just updated that, and they're estimates of prevalence is 1 in 59 children now are believed to have some form of autism. And that makes it the most common disability. So this is, you know, we always say, even if your child doesn't have autism, you know, everybody should know something about autism, because in your community, somebody your child goes to school with, when you go to the grocery store, you're going to interact with people. This is going to affect everybody. If the rates are 1 in 59, this is going to affect all of us, because these are the people in our community. And you inevitably will have contact with someone on this autistic spectrum.
Do you have any hypotheses as far as why these rates have changed?
That is the million-dollar question. I wish I did. Some of the theories, no doubt, are, you know, absolutely better diagnostics. So when you and I were growing up, you know, the previous caller, he said his daughter had Asperger's. You know, we didn't previously recognize high-functioning forms of ASD like Asperger's. You know, we just had that classic idea of what autism looked like, and we didn't see all the different variations. We've gotten better at recognizing that it can come in various forms, so we've cast our net wider. We see the higher functioning forms of autism. The CDC, in their latest report, we're slowly getting better at recognizing it in girls. We know that autism looks different in girls. It does not look the same as it does in boys, and girls have autism. It's just a different presentation. So we're getting better at diagnosing it in all of its various forms. But even that being said, there does appear to be an increase, and we don't exactly know why. That's the bottom line.
We have another caller. We have Mary from Alexandria. Please go right ahead with your question or comment, Mary.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that, you know, back in the 1960s, kids with an autism spectrum disorder, they were often called, diagnosed as emotionally disturbed. The parent was blamed. Now, people who were in the system back then, they can have problems later in life, like depression. The problem is that if you end up in the mental health system later in life with a problem like that, due to what went on back in the 60s, you say anything about it, you can get attacked. Because I have had that experience. I didn't have autism, but I did have ADHD.
And you feel like that negatively impacted you as being identified as that?
No, it wasn't being identified. Mm-hmm. It was the theories that were being taught, Freudianism.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot of this, and it had a bad impact on my family, being blamed like that. I mean, this would be true whether it was autism or ADHD. The problem is you end up in the system later in life as something like depression. You can't tell people about it. You get attacked, and I have been attacked. I've been called delusional and screamed at and insulted quite a few times.
So you feel like it was negative that your parents were blamed, or that instead of this being recognized as a neurological type of thing?
My parents were blamed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The patients were blamed also.
Saying Mary's bringing up a really good point. Despite all the progress we've tried to make with all forms of mental health and mental health awareness, and Dr. Visconti does a great job on her show. It's one of the whole purposes of the show, is really trying to decrease the stigma of mental health issues in general. And, you know, NAMI is an organization. It's actually run by patients, clients who are in the mental health system, and it's just trying to decrease any type of negative association. The truth is, 1 in 5 individuals will experience some type of mental health issue in their lifetime, be it depression, schizophrenia, anxiety, some type of issue. Autism is a little bit separate from that. It's really seen as a neurobiological disorder as opposed to a mental health issue. Although I think what she's tapping into is, people often fear what they don't understand. Autism is no different. It has a negative history. If we go way back to the 1940s, there was a refrigerator theory mother, that these mothers just weren't engaging and warm enough with their children, and that's why their children were distant and not connected. And initially, in the very early stages, we did blame the mothers. That theory obviously was wrong, and it was corrected. But medicine grows and changes, psychology grows and changes as we learn. And so this field is no different than many other fields. She's right about that.
Thank you for your comment, Mary. And I want to invite our other listeners to join our conversation. The number is 1-800-552-8502. And I know that we're still learning a lot, but as of right now, what do we think, what do we suspect, what do we hypothesize causes autism?
There's a bunch of, we do know what can increase your risk for having a child with autism. So, for instance, one of the factors, we know that mothers who are advanced maternal age is a risk factor. One of the newer areas of research that came out is moms that were very young were at increased risk for having a child with autism, teenage moms. And that confused us for a bit, but then we understood that it's the prenatal environment, and it was lack of folic acid. So women who do not take adequate folic acid, particularly in their first trimester, that can put you at increased risk for having a child with an autistic spectrum disorder. And a lot of teenage moms are either in denial about being pregnant or don't seek prenatal care right away and therefore don't get prenatal vitamins. That's a risk factor. Other risk factors seem to be associated with inflammation during pregnancy. So women who have serious infections when they're pregnant, low birth weight or small for gestational age, certain medications, that can be a risk factor. Advanced paternal age is also a risk factor. And there's a few studies. It's hard to find well-controlled environmental studies, but there's some studies from California that indicate women that were exposed to certain pesticides when they were pregnant, or women who lived next to freeways and were exposed to heavy freeway traffic. That increase the risk factor. So this is just risk factor. As I list all of this, I'm very aware that I'm sitting next to Mary Catherine, and we've discussed this. She had none of those risk factors. If you want to talk about that, Mary Catherine.
Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, it's very frustrating for a mom that I didn't have any of these risk factors, yet here I am. I have two kids on the spectrum, and it's something, it was a hard pill to swallow. After Grayson was born and, you know, later diagnosed, I knew the second child was at a greater risk of having autism, so I did all these crazy things. Like, I heard, you know, induction could be correlated to autism. So I was like, oh, I'm not going to be induced, and so I went to 41 weeks. I don't think I ever put Sutton down the first year of his life because I was so afraid that I wasn't going to bond with him. But, you know, here we are. And so I just, it's such a, something that really bothers me. Like, I really would like to know, because it's just, I have such guilt about it.
And I would say it, with the families coming through the Children's Center, that most of them don't have these risk factors listed. Every now and then we'll see it, but there's, you know, there's no way to tell exactly what causes it. We wish we knew. We wish we could do something about it if we knew. I just wanted to mention that if you have a child that's having any kind of developmental delays, if you know, most kids up to a year, they're not required. Parents aren't expecting them to do a whole lot. So, but they are really developing and developing communication at that time. So even a one-year-old who is not yet talking, some do, there's a lot of variation in what kids do at a year, but even if they're not talking, we're always looking at how else they could be communicating. So are they pointing? Do they understand, you know, verbal directions along that are in context, with gestures? Are they responding to their name? Are they looking and smiling at their parents? If not, you need to tell your primary care physician and get referred for a developmental evaluation.
And we have another caller. We have David from Natchitoches. David, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Thanks so much. The program is extremely interesting so far.
Thank you.
Only comment I would make is that you've mentioned the need for control studies, you know, a number of times during the conversation. I just wonder if we were talking about the efficacy of, let's say, crossing guards at a school, and you were going to have a control group and an experimental group. What would your expectations be for the parents and the kids of the control group that you're not going to put a crossing guard at. What do we have to lose by trying THC, for instance?
Yeah, and that's a research dilemma, and I'm happy for y'all to talk about that dilemma because I know it is quite a dilemma.
Yeah,
that's a dilemma. And I'm glad I'm not in charge of designing those research studies. That's kind of above my pay grade. I will say I'm in very much in favor of, and I personally support these studies, because if this can help these parents, we want to get it out there and in the hands of parents as quickly as possible. But in all good conscience, we have to know the answer. We have to know that it's safe and at what dosage and all of that. So the design of the study and how it'll be done, those types of questions, that will be worked out by, there's a lot of research that goes on at LSU by groups that do clinical research trials currently. Dr. Horton is doing an autism study right now looking at a medication. Dr. Van Cherry does a lot of clinical trials in a variety of different areas. LSU they have a lot of research going on in a variety of different areas. They're well equipped to handle these types of questions. Mike McGill and myself primarily are clinicians. We are actually the folks who make the initial diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. So an actual design of a study, I can't tell you the specific details. Other than, you know, we are very much in favor of helping parents who have children with these challenging behaviors. We see it, and we see every day how hard it is for these families.
And I do know, with the limited amount of research experience that I have, that what typically will happen is that there will be a research group and a control group, and the control group is the one that does not receive the treatment. And if the results are looking promising, then the study will be open to all participants. It will be what's called unblinded, and so then everyone will receive the treatment. And so that's one way to try to address this problem, but unfortunately the best way for us to figure out whether something is effective or not is to have that control group type research. But it's really a quandary, and mm-hmm. it's heartbreaking for parents who are having to sit back and wonder, is my child receiving, you know, the treatment or not. We have another caller. We have Michael from Minden. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Michael.
I was wanting to know, he touched on it since I called, but the very earliest signs on how you can tell. Because my son, he's had the behavioral, whatever, specialist look, and nobody really knows, but there are signs. So I wanted to know better what the very first signs you can see are.
Sure. So in kids as young as 12 months, we can start to see signs and symptoms of autism spectrum disorder. Like I was saying earlier, even if a child is not using speech, say, you know, between 1 and even up to 2 years, even if they're not using many words, I'm always interested in how they're compensating for their lack of communication. And so if they're really not interested in engaging with, especially with their parent, the only time they engage you is if they need you to do something for them, or if they can't do it for themselves, so they're making requests. There's really, you know, the lack of eye contact, the lack of the social smile, and also just odd or repetitive stereotype kind of behaviors, which might look like hand flapping, it might look like lining up toys, it might look like flicking their fingers, or it might look like holding on to a toy that they don't want to put down, or they have difficulty with transitions. I would encourage you that if you do have questions, to contact us at the Children's Center. Our number is 813-2960.
Mike, could you give it again?
Sure.
A little more slowly.
Sure. Thank you. So it's area code 318-813-2960. You can also go online to just, you could just Google LSU HSC Children's Center, and online you can fill out an intake referral form, and that comes across, it actually comes to my email, and we'll get that and we'll call you back and could send you a packet, and we would be happy to look at you know, your child, and we can, even if it's not autism, if your child's behind in any kind of development, we can help with that. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure. I just want to quickly, too, talk about early steps, and Mary Catherine's familiar with early steps. Early steps is a federally funded program that all the states have, and it serves kids with developmental disabilities from ages birth up to 3 years old. And it's, so I'm going to give the number here for Early Steps in a second, but Early Steps providers, it's unique in that the Early Step provider comes into the home and works with the parent. So for, say, an hour a week, because we know an hour a week of therapy is not the trick. That's not going to do a whole lot. But what we're trying to do is help the parent, guide them and how to, as a speech-language pathologist, how to increase communication and social interaction. And I will say that the parents are typically the experts. I know Mary Catherine, with her two sons, is awesome. She's one of the best therapists out there, and I learn from her every week.
Well, that's sweet of you to say. I don't know about that.
But Mary Catherine, did you want to talk about what were your, like, what the signs that first brought you to be concerned about your sons, and what made you first
and
go
as
on
we're,
this journey?
We're talking about this, and I'm realizing, like, we're saying, you know, even like babies, you can kind of sometimes realize that there's signs that early, but with my boys, you know, they met all of their milestones, especially within that first year. Grayson even walked at, you know, 9 months, and so I had no idea anything was amiss. I think it was probably a little after his first birthday that I started noticing some signs. So, you know, I know Michelle, you can talk more about it, but there's two types of autism. There's the kind that they never progress, and then there's the kind that they maybe start regressing. And so there was it was a subtle change, but I just started noticing a slight drift in eye contact and, you know, just their wanting to be around us. And Grayson had gestures and he lost them. And I just, you know, I feel like there's, you know, that second type we can't forget either. They were even keeping tabs on my second child because of Grayson. And, you know, he was developing beautifully until about 16 months. And then all of a sudden, I just noticed that, you know, we lost some things that we once had, and he just wasn't progressing with his peers.
I want to invite our other listeners and to call in with your questions at 1-800-552-8502, and obviously any comments are also welcome. We are appreciative of Dub and Mary and David and Michael for all calling in, and please, anyone else out there that has a question, feel free to call in. So, and Mike, you were talking about this with evaluations at the Children's Center. Y'all accept a wide variety of insurances and things
yes.
like that. So
we do. So we accept Medicaid, all major insurances. So there's a little bit of a process, but we are typically getting in families within about 6 weeks from start to finish now. So there's not a really long waiting list at this point.
Which is actually, that may sound long, but us within the mental health profession know that sometimes it can take months to get someone in to
right.
be seen. So 6 weeks is actually not bad at all.
Right. If I could just chime in and add something just to expand on what Mary Catherine said, the two types of autism. It does, in the field, we kind of know it as two points of presentation. There are those babies who from birth kind of were different. There's such a thing as too good of a baby. So the baby who never cries, the baby who's content to lay in its crib and doesn't want to be picked up and doesn't want to be held. And when you pick it up, they don't mold to you. They're kind of stiff and rigid. The baby who just loves to stare at the ceiling fan for hours on end, who actually gets fussy if you handle the baby too much. That's kind of when autism can present from birth. And, you know, we know these children, we watch the home video movies, and we can tell even by 12 months of age when the family's singing happy birthday and getting animated, we look back and we see this baby didn't get excited. This baby didn't smile in response to everybody smiling and clapping. The baby wasn't really interested in what was going around them at the birthday party. And then there's other children, like Mary Catherine's boys, who are developing beautifully, who are reaching their language milestones, who might be saying words, who might have five or more words. And then somewhere between the ages of 16 or 24 months, they change. And it can be subtle and slowly over time, but they begin to lose eye contact. They might lose the words they had. They stop talking. And they become more distant, more withdrawn. They become less animated. So you see less smiles, less giggles. And that child changes. And the parent feels like they've lost their child they had. They withdraw inward. And that's called the regressive type of autism. And that, in some ways, is even more devastating because the parent really feels like they've lost the child they had. So it's two different onset of the symptoms from birth or somewhere between 16 to 24 months. All of the symptoms of autism will present by 3 years of age, though. So if your child has not presented with these symptoms by age three, it is not autism. Autism, it might be diagnosed, it might not be caught till after three, but the symptoms are there by age three.
And we have another caller. We have Jordan from Shreveport. Jordan, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, ma'am. I was calling just to say that Dr. Yetman actually diagnosed my daughter with autism, but I do have a question for her.
Sure, go ahead.
My question for her is, right now, we are obviously in ABA therapy, and we're at Holy Angels, which we love it.
Great.
And also, my question is the question to actually get her into early childhood special education. Mm-hmm. Is that something that we need to do right away, or is ABA a good thing to stick with?
How old's your child?
She's four.
She's four. Okay. Well, okay. Good for you for being on top of it. Just for the listeners, I'll explain. ABA stands for Applied Behavioral Analysis. So this is a great mom who obviously did everything she was supposed to do. Applied Behavioral Analysis is one of many treatments we have, but ABA has, we have over 30 years of research showing that it can really be effective in the treatment of autism. It can improve IQ. It can improve language skills. It can reduce some of those challenging or negative behaviors. For a long time, we did not have any ABA services in the state of Louisiana. Through fighting and lawsuits of families who had children with autism, we finally got these services, and Medicaid and insurance pays for it. This is wonderful, but this has only happened in the last several years. When I first moved here 17 years ago, we did not have any ABA services for these families. So I'm very happy that we have these services and families can access them. So it doesn't have to be an either or choice, though. You can take advantage of both. So your daughter's four, with, quote, a special need, she's entitled to have services through the school system. So she can be enrolled in school, have special education services, get speech, probably speech language therapy through the school or any other services she would get. And she could also continue to get ABA services through Holy Angels. So you could actually get both. Do you want to say anything about that, Mike?
No, I agree. And through the school system would be considered early childhood special education. Your ECSC is the acronym. And I agree. So ABA, it's a proven therapy that works with kids with autism. I would say the benefits of being in the school system, however, is that she would be mainstreamed with some other children who are typically developing and be around good language models. As long as she is supported, you know, we would never want to set a child up for failure. So as long as the child is supported, which she would be if she were in early childhood special education. And so I agree with Dr. Yetman in saying that you could do both of those things.
We want to invite our listeners to join our conversation with any questions or comments. Please call at 1-800-552-9222. 8502. So early intervention, how important is it, and how early is too early, or is there too early?
There's never too early.
And right now, I think the national average for diagnosing children with ASD is 4.
Mm-hmm.
In Louisiana, it's 6, I believe. Now, we see a lot of children at the Children's Center that are referred to us, and I think our average age of diagnosis last year was around 3.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, we beat the national average and the state average, and we were very proud of that fact.
And so we get a lot of referrals from early steps, though. So if a child's in early steps, and again, early steps, and I'm going to give this number after this, but early steps is for any child who might have a developmental disability to take advantage of early intervention. Early intervention works. So early steps, what comes out to the house, they evaluate the child. If they qualify for early steps in any domain, so they look at their gross motor and fine motor skills and cognition and communication and kind of self-help skills. So if they're significantly behind in any of those areas, they can qualify. Also, certain just genetic disorders automatically qualify kids for early steps. And the therapist comes to the home and works with the parent. And each family has what's called an FSC or a family service coordinator to help. So, you know, any kind of developmental disability, we encourage kids, when we get a referral for a child that's not going to be seen for, say, 6 weeks, we always try to refer them to early steps and say, and start that process. The early steps number, I'm going to say this slower, is 318-226-8038. You can also go to www.earlysteps.dhh.louisiana.gov, or you could just Google early steps. That would be easier.
Yeah. And if I could just add, it doesn't make a difference. It makes an absolute difference. It has to do with the neuroplasticity, the young developing brain. The earlier you get a child into intervention, the better overall lifetime outcome they can have. You can have a lot bigger impact on a child when they're young than waiting and delivering those same services when they're older. So it has a huge difference. Both of Mary Catherine's boys received early intervention when they were how old?
Grayson started speech at 18 months and then ABA at 22 months, and Sutton started ABA and speech at 16 months. And we've just noticed incredible, incredible gains.
So the research, there's ample research behind it. The earlier, the better, and it can affect the overall lifetime earning potential and the overall lifetime functioning potential of a child.
So we have a caller that has a question, and the question is vaccinations and the impact on autism. Any comments, information?
Yes, I'll take that one. So that's an important one. That came out of this whole kind of question came out of a study that was published in The Lancet by Dr. Wakefield. And he had looked at a very small number of children. I think it was 12 patients. And he had hypothesized that perhaps the measles in their GI tract was related to their autism symptoms. The Cliff Note version is Dr. Wakefield had lost his medical license. He was banned from practicing medicine in England because of unethical behavior with patients. The Lancet subsequently retracted that article and said they never should have published it. It wasn't sound science. It got on the internet. It spread like wildfire. And many people caught on to this idea that maybe there was a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Numerous studies, organizations, the World Health Organization, the Academy of Pediatrics, National Institutes of Health, looked at this over and over again and have found no relationship. We looked at studies countries where before they introduced the MMR and after they introduced the MMR and their rates of autism. It's heavily researched and there is no connection. One really negative side effect, though, from this is in 2000, we had no cases of measles in the United States. We had completely eradicated measles from the United States. But then what happened was people started thinking that maybe there was this connection when there wasn't, and we had populations in California and different places starting to not vaccinate. And you have to have a large percentage of your population vaccinated in order to keep that herd immunity. We don't have measles in this country, but what we have is imported measles. So people come from other countries like the Philippines, where they do have measles, and carry measles in. If your population is well vaccinated, it'll just die off. But if your population is not highly vaccinated enough, it can take hold and spread. And that's what happened out in California. And I think it was 2014, we jumped to almost 600 cases of measles. There was an outbreak in Disneyland. There was also an outbreak in the Amish community in Pennsylvania. The Amish do not vaccinate for religious reasons. And so we went from having like zero cases of measles in 2000 to over 600 cases 14 years later. And that had to do with the false belief that there was a connection. I can't stress it enough. It's been very well studied. The research is available for people who want to look at it online, but there's an equal amount of just propaganda or false research out there. So you have to be a very savvy consumer. You have to know it well. If parents have concerns, talk to your pediatrician about that. This, they are well informed on the topic, and they can answer any concerns you have. But it's a really good example of false information can also cause real damage and cause real problems in our country.
We have another caller. We have Joe from Shreveport. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Joe.
My question is this. CBD ingredients in marijuana have been shown to be very effective in seizure disorders, and they're doing studies now on autism with the same drug. My question is, why can't the states get together on this research and say, hey, this works, you know, and make it available to the people who need it?
That's a good question, Joe. Sounds like we've got a lot of support out there for CBD oil. That is a good question. CBD oil has been, Joe is correct, CBD oil has been shown to be effective for certain individuals with certain types of seizure disorder. And that is why it's also been effective as a treatment for multiple sclerosis, obviously cancer patients. It can help them. There's numerous medical conditions. I think there's a dozen medical conditions that are listed as benefiting from from medical marijuana in general, and then CBD oil is a completely separate issue of all the conditions that can benefit from it. That's politics. It's a combination of politics and the FDA, and I don't think that's this show. That's a whole separate show. But all of us are interested, very much interested in seeing that research come out.
So we have talked about ABA also. What other treatments are available as far as autism spectrum disorder?
So a lot of children on the spectrum will do speech and language therapy, occupational therapy. They might do sensory integration. And with speech and language, so as a speech language pathologist, we're really trying to build communication. So however we can build communication. So that might involve using signs or gestures or something that Mary Catherine's very familiar with, which Sutton uses beautifully. It's called PECS, and that's just an acronym for a picture exchange communication system, where the child will use photographs or pictures, line-drawn pictures, to make requests. For instance, Sutton will bring Mary Catherine pictures of it's like these pictures on Velcro with Velcro backing, and he'll put them on a strip, and he'll find Mary Catherine, and he'll say, "I want cookie or I want candy, and he'll walk across the house and bring it to Mary Catherine and give it to her. So that's a great form of communication. He looks at her, he gives her that, and he gets his point across. Then Mary Catherine will take him to the pantry, lift him up, and he might say, eat, to get the cookie. So we're building communication the whole time. Other things such as floor time or Hannon, this is just using kind of play and naturalistic opportunities to build communication, to build circles of communication. There's a lot of sabotaging. So when a child does want something, you find something that they want, you might put it up and act like you don't know what they want and ask them what and see, you know, do they point to it? Will they use, ultimately we want them to use words, because words is always going to be the, you know, speech is going to be the most effective way to communicate. But there's all kinds of different strategies to use with speech and language and building communication.
So as far as the research goes, and I know we've talked about signs and symptoms and so forth, what do we know about autism, or are there just too many questions out there right now?
We've learned a lot, and we continue to learn a lot. So one of the really exciting areas of research going on right now is the Human Genome Project. So I think Mary Catherine really expressed it very well. You know, she's still, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you still want to know why.
You've never gotten
an answer as to why.
Right.
Right. And so that's probably the most common question we have, is we're able to explain the diagnosis, your child has autism, what this means, a treatment plan, but we can never tell them why. You know, when you have one child with autism, there's a 1 in 5 chance that any subsequent children you have will also have autism. We know that there's a strong genetic component to autism. We send families for genetic testing. The majority of time, that does not answer the question. It's usually only about 15% of times, 15% of the time can we find, you know, specific genetic reason why this is why your child has autism. You know, the genetic testing showed us X. A partnership that's going on right now between Hospital for Sick Children, Toronto, and Google is the 10,000 Genome Project. Every one of us, we have our own genome, and if I'm getting my numbers right, each person's genome has 10,000 bits of data. Your own personal genome has 10,000 bits of data, and they're getting 10,000 people. So 10,000 times 10,000, I can't figure out how many zeros, but obviously when you have that much data to figure out, who better than Google to partner with? So it's the first time a private hospital has partnered with a public entity like Google to take on this project. And the hope is, with that much data mining, that they will be able to give mothers like Mary Catherine a very specific answer, like, this is why your specific child has autism. This is what we've been able to find from their genome. So this Human Genome Project, which is going on now, but it will take several years, we hope it will be able to answer, to bump that 15% up to a much higher number, so that we will be able to answer the why for a lot more parents.
Mary Catherine, we have a few minutes left, and I'm going to ask you a very difficult, very broad question, and feel free to share as much as you feel comfortable. But what advice do you have for parents out there?
I mean, number one, get help. Like, if you, like, we've all talked about this, like, it's mother's instinct. Like, you really are the one that can advocate for your child. You're the one that, you know, at the end of the day, you've spent the most time with them. If you feel something's wrong, you know, Mike has told us about early steps. He's told us about calling LSU, do it. There's no harm in it. Like, the kids actually have fun at LSU, you know. So I'd say just get help, find support system. I have friends, you know, that have kids on the spectrum, and we get together and, you know, like, just vent, talk it out. Support from your family, support from your friends. They all want to help. They might not understand what you're going through, but they definitely want to help you. It's been such a humbling experience for me. I never thought I would have a child on the spectrum, but I do. And it's just opened my eyes up to so much, you know, the world is just so much bigger than I thought it was. And so, I don't know, I just, there's hope. And if you are worried, I can tell you from personal experience, just getting that early intervention, my kids have done so, so well. Grayson went from being a child who never spoke, and, you know, if you took his toy away, he would throw a 45-minute tantrum, and now he's in a typically developing classroom. So, you know, it's just, they've come miles, and even though Sutton's not talking, he's using this great communication system, and we've just seen so much progress, and I'm just thankful every day for all the people who help us and have this knowledge and have been able to share it with me. And so, like I said, just anybody who's worried, that's my number one advice. Just seek help, and hopefully, you know, it turns out to be nothing, but you'll just feel better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing your experience and your information that you have. I think it's really, you know, all of us experts can speak about it, but it's completely different living it.
Right.
And so we really appreciate the input that you've had with this program. Mike, would you mind giving those numbers one more time for
Sure.
like the Children's Center and for Early Steps and those
Sure.
programs?
Right. So LSU HSC, LSU Health Sciences Center, we're part of the School of Allied Health, the Children's Center. We're located behind University Health and the Medical School on Claiborne Avenue. Our number is area code 318-813-2960. And also we have our website, so you could type in LSU HSC Children's Center and go to our website. And Early Steps, they're located on Centenary Boulevard, but their phone number is area code 318-226-8038.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Yetman. Thank you, Mike, also for all your input and information that you have provided. And Mary Catherine, as I said before, thank you for bringing a different perspective to this topic. We really appreciate all of the information that y'all have shared this evening.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Views expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily express those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Phone assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Al Villarreal. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.